I miss those sounds, and I don't want them streamed to me. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. As we have all been distracted with the American democratic crisis, the world turns. As I record this, another lockdown in London, where I live, more across Europe, Germany, Spain, France, even Eastern Europe, and of course, America is reeling from the pandemic. I don't know about you, but my usual suspects are closed. My favorite restaurants and stores and movie theaters. I love movies, and almost every weekend I take my sons to a show and munch some popcorn and escape. Movie theaters were one of the first businesses to have closed because of COVID-19, and they are in a way the most visible measure of an economy under siege. Names like Regal and AMC may never reopen. In the U.S., leaders of the nation's movie businesses are calling on Washington for help. They issued a letter last week cautioning that nearly 70% of small and mid-sized movie theater companies will be forced to file bankruptcy to close permanently without help. Hollywood isn't releasing big movies like Time to Die, a Bond movie, because release it to who? Where? The cinema industry is worth billions of dollars. And get this, many movie theaters help to drive people to retail stores in malls, which are also under incredible economic pressure. So in this backstory, we talked to two experts. One of them is an old friend who runs movie theaters in Russia and says, surprisingly, he's doing better than his American counterparts. All right, I want to introduce you, first of all, to Paul Heth, who is with Carol Film Group, which is a leading Russia cinema operator. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Dana.
And Rob Arthur, who is speaking to us from Edinburgh. Paul is in Florida right now. Rob Arthur is with thebigpicture.com. And Rob, as I understand, you guys essentially are consultants for a lot of different cinemas.
That's right, from China, Kazakhstan, Belarus, all the way through to the UK.
All right, I have to confess, I know Paul for many years because Paul, now that he is the big cinema operator, in fact, used to run one theater, is where he got his start. Paul, it was at the Radisson Hotel, right, in Moscow.
1993, very correct. Great memory.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, I know you say that often and you talk to people about that, but that is a hell of a journey. Starting yes. off in rough and tumble Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. I don't know what year it was, but, you know, business was all trying to get a grip and they were shifting to capitalism. And you started with one theater and then you went on to build such a major business in Russia.
Yeah, thank you, Dana. Yes, I don't know if someone could ever redo deal with those circumstances and that opportunity, but you're correct. We started with a cinema in a lobby of the Radisson Slovyanska for expats. When in Russia, there were no cinemas open because they lost government support as part of perestroika. And then we moved on. We got a top Kodak in investing some money and we did a marquee cinema in Pushkin Square. And then I had the great chance to work with the Redstone family on a large enterprise. And then we kept growing, growing, growing.
So how many cinemas do you have now?
We have 47 properties. And in total, our enterprise group is about 400 screens.
And Rob, you have a long past as well with cinema, because I'm reading that you oversaw 14 cinemas, 83 screens at one point with Apollo Cinemas, and then you went on to work with Curzon Cinemas.
That's right. And prior to that, can I say, we watched on with envious eyes when I was working with Warner Village as the regional director in London, wondering who this guy Paul Heth was that was making all these inroads in Russia. I guess it gets into the blood. You work in cinema and we tend to travel far and wide as we go. It was really interesting. It's just picking up on Paul's point about embargoes or restrictions in Russia. Does that sound so similar to Saudi Arabia today?
Yes, yes. And as a matter of fact, Rob, I obviously know and I'm friends with Mr. Oakes, with Millard. And I remember Warner Brothers visited early on in my career, and we were discussing with Millard about doing something, and it didn't pan out. But obviously, what you guys did in a lot of markets was well noted.
Yeah. Can I jump in and say, you know, as we're speaking, it's great to talk about success, but As we're speaking here, France is shutting down for more lockdown because of COVID-19. So is Germany. So is Italy and Spain. And the UK is probably going to shut down and do more serious closures than it's already doing regionally. Does this spell the death for many entertainment venues, especially cinema?
Yeah, I think that it was inevitable that these situations would come up right now. And I fortunately or unfortunately spent time in Taiwan 2002, 2004 and saw the impacts there. Consumers are, they're fearful of going out. They're being told by government every day to stay in. The narrative is very negative in that sense. And until there's some clearance and also some Hollywood content, especially in Western Europe, to be able to play, that makes it very difficult where there's been a perhaps an over-reliance on that, on the Hollywood content and Los Angeles to deliver that in to these markets. It may be quite different, I guess, for yourself, Paul, because you've got a much stronger local content in Russia.
Yeah, Paul, before we talk about the content production, though, I mean, even in Russia now, everybody has to wear masks and, you know, despite the fact that the Kremlin brags of a vaccine, I mean, people are generally going into lockdown and they are generally not going out now. And you must be feeling it.
Yes, you're correct. And we, mainly for us, for the theaters, we're feeling a lack of content, which is, we believe, limiting consumers' want to go to the theater. We're fortunate we do have some local production. I would say that we're probably seeing it less in Russia. They seem to be more stoic, more accepting of life's challenges. So we haven't seen a big drop off on attendance when we have content. Having said that, though, we're working with capacity and emissions restrictions. So we keep, but you know, to keep social distancing, we're running about 35% of our physical space available for seating. So we have a 50% capacity rule, but then we have space between patrons. So we're running, you know, with guidance from the health authorities and so on and so forth.
Are people wearing masks? Do you do anything with the air or? No, I mean, I would be scared to take my kids to a cinema right now. And you guys can both snicker at me, but in general, I just don't want to go where there's a lot of people.
Well, it's interesting. I saw a study recently that there's been no confirmed case of any COVID being, what's the medical word, being contracted by a visit to the cinema globally, as far as we know. But having said that, obviously, if you're interacting with people, there's a chance, whether it be in the pharmacy, the supermarket. It's interesting, Dana, if you go to big box retail like Walmart or the Russian equivalent, the hypermarkets, they're packed. But, you know, in very close circumstances in the aisles. But I would say, of course, I believe it, to go back to your comments, that if we believe that there'll never be a vaccine or therapeutics, yes, this is probably going to radically change people's ability to want to go to entertainment venues.
Rob, how does this radically change, if I can jump in there? How does it radically change? Because
I just think like you and your family, Dana, that maybe mom and dad are nervous of bringing their kids to a public forum where they may think there's not access, but exposed to people that may not be healthy. I'm a half full kind of a person. I do believe that there'll be a future. And I do believe that the medical issues will be addressed. It's not if or it's when. But the big issue is, can a lot of companies survive to get to when?
Rob, how does it radically change? I mean, you've seen Cineworld here in the UK. Just, you know, what are they? They closed 130 cinemas, and they're talking about possibly will they close another 500 in the US? I mean, how do these businesses adjust?
So some of the operators, it's hard to say that they will survive. They went into the pandemic highly leveraged. They've tried to raise new debt going through the process, and it's become a cash and liquidity crisis for those companies. And I think a key part is that if shareholders aren't supportive of those companies in those markets, that's very difficult for them in their current guise to survive. But there are other
The numbers are that 70%, I think this is more of an American number, but still, I think it applies across Europe in many instances. 70% of small and mid-sized theater companies will be forced to declare bankruptcy or go out of business without government assistance. And right now, I haven't seen the government stepping up with much of anything. Have you?
I doubt that there'll be anything until after the presidential election in the US. And there's likely to be more constraint in Western Europe, as there's other, I guess, other sectors vie for that position in that time. But can I say that the feedback that I'm getting from the investment market is that they're highly supportive of cinema. They see a big shift from retail and shopping experience into cinema-led leisure experiences in those boxes or those areas. So cinema does have to reinvent. And it may well be that the debt and the bondholders or the leaseholders or this or the landlords of those entities have to take control of some of those locations. That kind of is what happened in Ireland in the global financial crisis 2008-2009, where shopping centres were taken over by their owners and retailers were taken over, or cinemas, to make sure, because there's a contagion impact. If the cinema's not there, the footfall isn't there, it has an impact on the other retailers and locations. So we can see that happening again.
Paul, you want to jump in here?
Sure. I'd say there's probably three points here, Dana, three issues. One, the company you mentioned, Cinemark, and we have an equivalent in the United States, which is also in the UK with Odeon, AMC. They were extremely leveraged before the pandemic at numbers, frankly, I don't want to use the word irresponsible, but very high levels that obviously their shareholders and their board agreed to, but they were levered like 6-7 times their earnings, which for me is not sustainable business model before the pandemic. So I think going into the pandemic, obviously folks that had encumbered or impaired balance sheets are going to have a tough time. I mean, in Russia, we're a little bit more fortunate because, you know, Dana, in emerging market, you're more conservative with your capital because there's always a crisis. And in 2014, we had a ruble crisis, which forced us to work with our landlords to go more percentage rents, build up capital reserves, be a bit more responsible. And I think, unfortunately, the two companies I mentioned really got stuck at a bad time in their balance sheet history. Now, I'd also say that, again, my feeling is when we looked at the market, there's a lot of challenges. There's streaming in the home. People can watch things at home. People are anchored to the couch with the TV with these great media centers. But we understand that from a content perspective, which I think the lessons being learned, the motion picture really can't return capital without theater. So these big productions.
So tell me, that goes back towards where Rob was starting with content.
Yeah.
But can you explain that to me? Because I don't quite understand that. I mean, what is the, if they haven't released a lot of big films like here, you know, they That's talk right. endlessly about James Bond didn't come out, right?
And That's right.
So how can they survive if they can't fill a theater seat properly? And then you're saying at home, they just don't get the numbers either.
Right, that's correct, Dana. So I would say, and I'm a bit of an expert on this because I have a company called Monumental, and we co-invest in studio pictures for our markets. You know, so we've partnered with Fox, with Disney, and with Sony on a number of co-productions. So there, I haven't seen a business model that allows an investor in motion pictures to return capital on that investment without the theatrical platform. And I think when you look at the American studio companies, the one like you mentioned, Bond, which is MGM, it's a UK as well, the Broccoli family. But these large productions, they absolutely need the theater platform to justify the investment in the first place. In my opinion, if you follow the money, if the studios really believe that there was a model that video on demand from the home would cover the cost of these productions, return the profit that they would theatrically, what a great time to do it right now. But the ones that were tried, including Mulan by Disney, I think Trolls was a lesser success. I just don't believe anybody thinks that model replaces the theatrical platform, then in home viewing, then in terrestrial TV, like the 5 or 6 platforms that generate the revenue.
Rob, and so, you want to also just tag on there? Because, you know, it's interesting. You guys are both experts at this, right? But in terms of content, I'm reading where big companies like Apple, Amazon, Netflix have considered buying theaters and are already committing to doing so because they understand, as Paul says, that you need that theater to put your content on and really generate the big numbers. But in COVID-19 environment, you may be doing so at a loss or a break even or something.
So we've looked at, I guess, that question of vertical integration, which I think is primarily a North American discussion point, because if you take, say, the discussion Paul's just had with Monumental and Caro, If I go to Japan, there's Toho, who are producers, distributors, exhibitors, vertically integrated, CJ, CGV in Korea. And you also have a range of Chinese production outfits, which are also producing, exhibiting, distributing in China. So it's a fairly typical model in emerging and international markets, but not so in North America.
But when you talk about Asia, are those theaters running at a loss or are they making money?
No, they are back on track. They're running at about 75 to 80% of where they were in previous years. And in the last 2 weeks or so, Japan's had its largest ever local content opening. So there's significant returns to cinema in those markets, which we've identified as being most resilient during the COVID period. And they've contained and, as I identified, contained the issues, addressed the issues so far, but they also have
very strong. We're a long way away from that in Europe, that's for sure.
Yeah, very much so.
And then I would just make the point, I don't think Netflix or Amazon buys a theater circuit because, in my opinion, their theatrical films can get distributed anyway into that platform and tie up all that capital. The other thing, Dana, is, you know, as a theater operator, you need, last year, for example, Carol, we showed somewhere north of 500 motion pictures. So you need, even Amazon, as huge as they are, doesn't make near the amount, doesn't, their theatrical output would not even be a fraction of what's needed to pay the rent on a facility. You need significant pipeline of content. And
I assume the pipeline is slowing down because they're worried.
Right now, the pipeline is shut. Major films. You're absolutely correct. And there are films from kind of second tier, not second tier, but smaller outfits are using this opportunity to get their product out there. We're seeing a lot of art pictures and festival pictures. But again, I'll go back. I do think that in the late spring, early summer, that we'll see an unbelievable outpour of content back into the theaters once consumers feel like there's either a therapeutic or a vaccine. And the studios have also held back and announced they've pushed so much product. Like, for example, next year we have something like 9 Marvel movies on the calendar. I mean, it's just crazy. So, but you're absolutely correct.
Nine Marvel movies that are in production now, or
that are already in the
can. Holding them on the shelf.
Holding them on the shelf.
Really?
And they might be finishing post-production, but the point is, we have basically a blockbuster, or if not two, every week for like 45 weeks next year. That's assuming we get back open, and that's why I'm seeing mainly starting April, maybe through June, is that when consumer sentiment and these medical issues, at least even from a morale standpoint, if not even actually into the hands of the consumer, do people feel more safe going out?
Let me flip this around on both of you, because you're saying that the movie companies or the production companies need the theaters in order to move big content and big numbers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Malls need them because it drives some traffic through the mall, right? But yeah. Rob, you told me when I talked to you on the phone the other day that you think that some of those malls are not going to be around, period, never mind the health of the movie theater, that they could become distribution points for Amazon and that kind of thing.
And I think that that's a key piece. This is primarily a North American, Western Europe position where there's been an oversupply of retail space. So there's likely to be a contraction of up to 30% of that retail space in those markets. So,
it's 30% of the malls or just 30% of retail content, and that will shake out depending on where it's loaded in
30% of the malls are likely to close or be repositioned as partly mixed use residential or last mile go-to points for Amazon.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, it's easy to say 30%, but when you imagine physically on the ground, 30% of retail going out of business and the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people employed in that 30%.
Yeah, I mean, I was just looking at, say, restaurants in the U.S., and it's a $900 billion industry per annum. So it's got huge, and it's millions and millions of people who work in the casual dining sector, which is a key part of those malls. But it's Macy's, JCPenney's, Bloomingdale's. All of those units they're dispensable now as the retailers or consumers are concerned. So Some of those and the most successful have to be converted into most more experiential or leisure oriented spaces.
So even if those theaters can survive in those on their own, collectively within a mall, there isn't going to be a mall to be in.
Yes, so there has to be a reposition of the mall's priorities, which should mean a move more towards experiential with cinema. And we're seeing that in Western Europe now. And
say that again? There should be a move towards?
So experiential development. So that includes cinema with the links to the studios, plus other forms, whether it be food, drinks, dining, other leisure forms, but cinema being a key component of that. Now, that means that the cinemas have to be much better than they were. And some of the work that was being done in the US especially was moving in that guise. In areas like whether it be Moscow or Istanbul, Almaty in Kazakhstan, they've got malls that are 2 or 3 years old. So they're in their infancy. They've already been moved towards more leisure and experiential. So they're there. They're much more sustainable.
How is it in Russia? Because if I'm not mistaken, you can set me straight, but, you know, I mean, going back 15 years in Russia when I lived there, I was there 10 years ago, but even 15 years ago, we're just starting to see those big malls open up.
That's right. And I think Rob made a good point, because we have contemporary physical plant or contemporary units. We have a lot of things that we're talking about trying to do in Western Europe and North America we've already done. You know, we call it next generation theaters, all reclining seating, fully automated. We have special ventilation, like you're talking about. For example, we already have a pipeline of we work with the streamers with our product. We just showed, for example, in all of our theaters, UFC fighting. Like with a lot of things that guys haven't done in these markets, plus the way we lay out our locations. So, Dana, I guess if you've been to Florida, you've been to Whole Foods, for example.
Sure.
So, like our concessions are more that type of a style with healthy alternatives, kind of a grab and go type, instead of kind of the slow over the counter. So a lot of those things we've already done.
UFC fighting as well. Do you have to have bouncers in Russia? It sounds like you're a little ruckus.
No, we've been okay. But I think also we have a big relationship with IKEA, and we're doing a massive development plan with them. They've also taken that kind of mindset and how they do the mall. So their feeling is, because remember, IKEA in Russia is a big mall operator. They have 16 of these super malls. 20, 30, 40 million admissions a year to the mall. And their idea is that retail is going, that people will go to these destination locations to experience products and brands, but not necessarily buy them. So it becomes more of a introduction of an experience to a consumer versus the actual retail trade, because people are buying at the home. So I think in the US,
they're all saying that the emerging markets, which, you know, generally are on the tail end of development,
that's right,
are leading in this area, right? And maybe
because we just have more
better than traditional markets like the US.
Yeah, because we don't have such legacy assets and historical assets. And I would say in the United States is that I worked, partnered for the American company, had screens in the US in the early 2000s with the Redstones. But I think that the American market is just vastly overscreened. And I think part of what's going to happen, I believe that the American cinema market, the screen count will contract by 20%. But I don't think that necessarily means a 20% contraction in gross revenue. I think you'll see more output in the other locations. But the locations that end up staying will have to have all the things I just mentioned. And we're also seeing kind of a migration from urban vertical offices, housing to people back in the suburbs. I think you'll see, as Rob mentioned, a reconversion of these malls into work, resident, entertainment experience versus just straight retail trade.
You may as well put residential in there, because if commercial is not doing very good, you need an alternative, right?
So. Yeah, in America, you know, has a lack of housing stock, right, as you know, so, or affordable housing, particularly for younger.
If I can end on something positive, there's always this struggle to generate local content or domestic content.
Yes.
Hollywood's always been, you know, the Bigfoot, and everybody goes to see those blockbuster movies. Is there an upside here in terms of the people who work in film and entertainment, and writers and actors and all of that, that suddenly local content becomes a lot more marketable and a lot more profitable than these just waiting for those big, you know, blockbusters to come out of Hollywood? Yeah.
Well, I think if you look for our market again, Dana, for the Russian market, which, by the way, is now, can you imagine when I started, it was about $1 million box office. Now we're about $1 billion. And we're the sixth largest film market in the world for admissions from zero. And by the way, analogy to people talking about streaming, killing cinema. When we started, everyone said, oh, people won't go back to the theaters because they had VHS tapes. You probably remember, Dana, all the black market on VHS. But I'd say that
never bought one of those.
No, never. But I would say, though, that local production was 1% of our box office when we started. It's about a third now of local production, which is a couple $100 million, right? And the other thing we see is now is that never in my career have I had access to so much content that could be put in a public fashion. So I do think
locally produced in terms of domestically produced in Russia.
Domestically produced, it's a third of our business, local language producers. But globally, if I even take English language, we have so much film being made now, whether it be Amazon, Apple, the studios. And I could go through a number of other producers and in the UK. So I just see there's
so to see them.
Yes. And we're seeing now, for example, in the pandemic, we're able to market now maybe some of the lesser known catalog of contemporary content. Particularly, we're doing really well with art product. It's like, you know, very sophisticated niche product and festival product. So I do see an upside, and we believe that the future of cinema will be not just cinema, but it's a destination to program content of all kinds with all this technology and the type of seating and communal interaction. So I'm very bullish on it.
Looking forward to having my new news program in Cairo film.
Exactly. There you go.
Rob, do you want to
take very excited about the future. I mean,
just to add on content.
Just to add to what Paul said, when I spent time in Kazakhstan, and my first reaction was, we had a Star Wars movie coming up. Let's work on this. Let's focus on this. And the guys locally were saying, no, we've got some Kazakh films coming out. These will work really well. So I spent the New Year period there when we're just looking through the films, and I was walking through the halls to see what was working. And, you know, it was really incredible. All the kids were coming in and the families were coming in to watch the Kazakh films. And they've moved from, say, 3 productions a year up to 50 in a relatively short space of time. I think the median age has a big impact there, and the content coming out of Hollywood, that there's much more reflection on local content, language, and culture in those areas. But
it's also so interesting because I grew up in Canada with CBC, where the government used to mandate national culture because we were worried about being overwhelmed by American culture. And what you're saying is that this just happens naturally in this environment, and it's a great thing.
It is. It's happening naturally. I'm going to give Turkey 60% is local content. I was speaking to African producers today who are saying, look, we've got a median age of 19 and a half. We need a different type of content for what would be the Nollywood or such, or Zollywood in Zimbabwe. They want something different, but they also want Hollywood.
Who's the biggest film star in Russia right now, Paul? There must be a few of them anyway.
I have to think about that.
I'm sure there's a number of them, right?
Yeah, I'd say there was probably two, in my view, there's maybe two or three Russian stars that ensure, but I'd say in Russia, it's more about, in my view, that based on that the lead producer and director are kind of the big brands, whether it be Mr. Bondarchuk or Mr. Ernst or people like that, Fedor Bondarchuk. They're kind of the above the title, a Fedor Bondarchuk movie, that's a big marketing hook, or a Konstantin Ernst produced movie. So it's a little bit going back to the 40s of Hollywood when you had the great producers like Louis B. Mayer and those guys, David Selznick. So in Russia, we're more like driven that way. But there's some up and coming stars. But having said all that, there's still excitement when Tom Cruise movie comes in, or, you know, some of these big Hollywood tentpoles. And right now, it's interesting. The studios need the theaters need the studios, but there is a future for both of us. We just have to get through this pandemic. So I'm optimistic.
I can tell you are, and that's great to hear after taking a look at some of the numbers, which are quite daunting. So,
yes.
Beth of Carol Film Group, great to talk to you. Rob Arthur of TheBigPicture.com. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much, Dana. Bye-bye.
And that's our backstory on cinemas and, by extension, the retail industry hammered by a pandemic. Please let it end soon. But realistically, we are in this movie well into 2021. I'm Dana Lewis. Please subscribe to Backstory. And if you want to sponsor the podcast, be in touch. Thanks for listening. And I'll talk to you again soon.